Hey everybody, welcome back to another week at the Damage Report. I am John Iadarola. It is Monday, so Brooke is here.
Yeah, it is Monday. I'm here.
Very excited to have you here.
Ready to go. Ready to be here.
Ready to have you here as well. Man, you're very colorful. I'm looking at the preview monitor and
I'm matching the background today.
Nice.
We did that completely on purpose.
I did the blue, so we will be debating here, okay?
You're gonna
be the Republican.
No, thanks.
No, okay. Okay, well then we won't do that. But we will talk about a lot of the news because there is so much to talk about. We've got Donald Trump. He's been taking some history courses, not to better understand our history, but to burn people. So we're gonna have some great examples of that. We've got an update on what's going on in Virginia. At the end of this, will there be any politicians left standing? We'll find out. Also, what do the American people think about blackface? We've got polls now. That should be fun. Mm-hmm. And talk about the Green New Deal has absolutely shattered the minds of everyone on the right. Media Matters has done an amazing compilation of the different talking points on Fox News about it. And it's madness up in here. And along the way, we have two awesome guests. So Amanda Turkel of the Huffington Post is gonna be joining us to break down her reporting on Amy Klobuchar, a newly announced contender in the Democratic primary this time around. And then Jenny Wetter is gonna be joining us a little bit later on the show from the Population Institute to break down some of what we can expect out of the Supreme Court having to do with reproductive rights in the next couple of years.
Yeah, so awesome.
Big show, lots to talk about. Let's jump into it.
Okay.
Donald Trump doesn't like Elizabeth Warren. It's not so much her policies that he's not a fan of. There's one little specific thing about her that he keeps coming back to, and he did it in a particular way that has generated, I think, some deserved conversation online when he tweeted, "Today, Elizabeth Warren, sometimes referred to me by me as Pocahontas, joined the race for president. Will she run as our first Native American presidential candidate? Or has she decided that after 32 years, this is not playing so well anymore? See you on the campaign trail, Liz." So if you have lived in America and if you know anything about what the American government has historically done to Native Americans, you know that a reference to a trail means a particular thing. And then the question becomes, does Donald Trump know that he is referencing the Trail of Tears, part of the systematic multi-decades or centuries long genocide against the Native Americans perpetrated by our country? What do you think?
You know what? Yes, I do think that I mean, here's the thing. We don't have to pretend that you have to be a historian to learn about the Trail of Tears. There are in so many ways our history books in elementary school fail. But I mean, we all learned about the Trail of Tears.
Yeah, we might not have learned about it in, you know, necessarily all of its full context.
It's like
and everything.
First grade. Yeah, so
but
I don't
you learn
think
about
that
it.
Right, he had to go far to know what he's doing.
Exactly. Yeah. And I hate that we even have to have the debate even for a minute. Obviously, that's what he's doing.
Yeah.
And if I seem a little bit down about politics today, it's for a few reasons. But one is I like having interesting news to talk about.
Yeah.
But I am so sick at this point of having to report that our president made a joke about the genocide of Native Americans.
Yeah.
Like, how depressing is that? Well, as a news viewer, as a news commentator, that like we never had Barack Obama. Oh yeah, he tweeted about concentration camps as a joke. We never had to do that.
Because he wouldn't.
Exactly, but with Donald Trump, we do have that. And so
the only thing they have in common, two things, they're men and they were president of the United States. There's nothing else.
Other than that.
Right, nothing.
Yeah, no, nothing else. And so some people are gonna deny that that's what he's doing. They're gonna say that after all that we know about Donald Trump, no, we couldn't be making a joke about that. And the way that they're going to make that case is gonna be a little bit condescending, not just towards us, but towards Donald Trump, which is gonna be fun when they throw him under the bus. But bear in mind that not too long ago, just a month ago, Trump tweeted, "If Elizabeth Warren, often referred to by me as Pocahontas, did this commercial from Bighorn or Wounded Knee instead of her kitchen, with her husband dressed in full Indian garb, it would have been a smash." So it's offensive in like seven different ways, but he has shown, what are you saying?
No, you go, I'm sorry.
He is perfectly happy to jokingly mock slaughters, massacres of Native Americans in this country.
And I guess this shouldn't be like a surprise or a shock, but just even the first sentence there where he says, and it was in that last tweet too, often referred to me by me as, you know, Pocahontas. Repeatedly, people have said, hey, this is racist, this is offensive, not just to her, but to so many Native Americans. Mm-hmm. This is offensive. And he keeps doing it. And just even that little bit, it just, I don't know, it could have even been left out of his burn. It's just that he that doesn't bother him. That's what strikes me as that, like, something that has just been so fairly criticized, mm-hmm. he isn't going to budge.
Yeah, there was.
He's just going to dig in. Now, I'm not even, I can't even begin to talk about the entire discussion of the racism and problematic things in the tweet. Just even that first part. Mm-hmm. I just don't
and
understand
he gets
why
away
he's
with
still
it.
Digging in.
Like there was a comedian years ago who said it was just because of what we have done to the Native Americans in our country that there's so few that you can just mock them. Like you just do and you get away with it. People don't take it seriously. They don't care. No. The horrific historic events that our country perpetrated are just, you just joke. And maybe it's racism, maybe it's not. It's not clear really. There's no reason he should be censured or anything like that. But Donald Trump, while he's a moron, has surrounded himself throughout his life by stupider people. And so if he wants to slide through this without being declared to be a racist, that's going to be undercut a little bit. He doesn't want you to think that he's talking about the Trail of Tears, but his son is an absolute moron and really undercut him there. So this guy, Michael Malice, had responded to Trump's tweet saying, "The Native American genocide continues with another murder by the president." And what you're seeing there is from Donald Trump Jr.'s Instagram, where he put that up on his Instagram and said, "Savage, love my president." So if Trump wasn't talking about the Trail of Tears or genocide against the Native Americans, his son certainly seems to have missed that message, because he thinks not only is that what the joke about, but it's savage.
I just think generally murder jokes are a little beneath the office of the presidency, including his son murdered. I don't know. It's like.
But look, as ridiculous as that is, I like this defense of Trump even better. So Brett Hume, who loves Trump, he tweeted in response to one commentator saying that it was about the Trail of Tears. Brett Hume says, "Yes, because Trump is noted for his knowledge of 19th century American history vis-a-vis the Native population. Geez." So what he's saying there is Trump is too stupid to be racist in this particular way. And that's a Trump supporter in the media saying that. He's a steadfast lover of Trump as president.
The best part of that tweet, though, is if you go and find it, the replies to it are people like giving all of these examples of Trump referring to history. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Brit has nothing to say.
Yeah, or specifically wounded knee and, you know, all of that. Like, that's stuff he's talked about. And look, I just want to end with just a little bit of the facts. Maybe Trump doesn't know about this stuff. Trump Jr. definitely doesn't. So hopefully they will watch this and learn something. The actual Trail of Tears, in brief, some 15,000 Native people died during the journey from exposure, malnutrition, exhaustion, and disease, including about 4,000 Cherokees. This was one of the singular worst events in an ongoing campaign to move and depopulate Native Americans from a number of parts of the US, either because the area was needed for settlement by Americans, for exploitation of resources and things like that. It was an explicitly incredibly violent and dishonest and racist campaign perpetrated by many politicians, but Andrew Jackson was one of the most significant. And look, Brett Hume, I don't know if you know this, but Donald Trump, who makes reference to few historical figures, he really does like Andrew Jackson, though. Repeatedly over the past year, this is by PolitiFact, Trump has invoked and praised his predecessor in the White House, who served from 1829 to 1837. In addition to various mentions in remarks and on Twitter, Trump placed a portrait of Jackson in the Oval Office and made a pilgrimage to the late president's tomb in Nashville less than 2 months after being sworn in. Andrew Jackson was president for some time. He did a lot of things. But one of the things, rightfully, that he is known and vilified most for is because he was one of the most aggressively, violently anti-Native presidents we've ever had in our past. He undertook barbarous campaigns against Native Americans. And Donald Trump, you can hope that he's just ignorant of that. I kind of think that that's not the case. I think that fits in perfectly with his not just presidency-long campaign against Natives, but throughout the course of his life, that has been a thing that has popped up very often. For whatever reason, Donald Trump, a guy who grew up in New York City, hates Native Americans and thinks that they are at best fodder for jokes. It is bizarre. It's a weird thing to have to say about your president, but it has been borne out through literally decades of his life.
Yeah, this is just a sad thing that Native Americans have to deal with, because these aren't even jokes that affect Elizabeth Warren. Mm-hmm. It's just a huge number of people that their president is supposed to be their president as well, just making fun of them and minimizing what has happened to their ancestors. And it's unfortunate.
It is. Okay, we're gonna take a short break. When we come back, Amanda Turkle of Huffington Post is gonna join us. The latest, Amy Klobuchar enters the Democratic primary. Some lingering issues about her staffing issues in the past after this.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be, featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity. The UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it,
"You must unlearn what you have learned."
And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
This weekend, Amy Klobuchar, Senator, launched as the latest Democratic nominee for the presidency, making the primary field even that much more crowded. And we're going to, tomorrow, we're gonna have an expert on from the Center for Public Integrity to break down some of her donors, prior fundraising, and things like that. We'll talk about her platform, everything. But in the days leading up to her announcement, there was some incredibly interesting original reporting from the Huffington Post having to do with her history of staffing issues. And we're now joined on the show by one of the two reporters doing that work. This is Amanda Turkle, Washington Bureau Chief for the Huffington Post. Amanda, welcome to the Damage Report.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Very glad to have you here. And so you spoke with a number of members of the senator's staff, and apparently there has been some issues with the way that she has previously treated them. Can you break that down for us?
Sure. So we talked to quite a few staffers who have worked for Amy Klobuchar over the years, and they say that she has mistreated them and in some ways is an abusive boss. And that's not to say that there's, you know, what you would think of as like sexual harassment or anything like that, but that she is, you know, she goes beyond the typical ways that a boss is supposed to treat an employee. She asks her staff to come to her house and do personal errands for her, things like washing the dishes or picking up dry cleaning. And those things are actually against the rules if you are a senator or a member of Congress. And just little things like she's constantly berating her staff. It's not uncommon for staffers to wake up in the middle of the night and see an email saying that you're the worst person who's ever worked for me. This is the worst thing I've ever seen. And that it just creates this feeling where they're constantly on edge and there's a lot of anxiety. And, you know, these are not people who have never worked for a woman in office, who have never worked for other Hill offices. They say that her behavior is unusual amongst this toxic environment on the Hill, which, you know, again, is not necessarily great a lot of times. And she's not alone in her behavior, but she has risen above some of the other bosses.
And as one example, perhaps, of that culture, the sort of knowledge of the staff of the way that she typically has been, there was like an 8-page advisory memo on how to deal with her in certain ways, like advice for new staffers.
Right. So this was during her first campaign in 2006 when she was running for Senate. She was then Hennepin County Attorney back in Minneapolis. And a lot of times you will have, I mean, this is really common when you're a campaign and you make a memo for staffers about how to deal with the candidate or with the politician. Things like make sure they always have a Diet Coke in their room. They like the room to be a little cooler when they arrive. You know, just standard things like that for staffing someone. You know, make sure she has her purse. Just really, really normal things. But this memo was unusual, according to people we spoke to, because there are a couple things in it. One was that it said in your free time, when you're at her home or waiting for her, you should pick up her laundry, organize her room, and just make her bedroom look tidy. That is not common. These people aren't maids. They're professional political staffers. And there was another warning of saying that if she's angry, just let her vent. This won't be the first time that you see her or hear her do this, and basically don't get in her way, which gives a hint at how she can have a temper that maybe gets out of hand at times.
So you also had a follow-on story a couple of days later talking about former Minority Leader Harry Reid having a talk with her about, you know, these rumors were going around. And so I'm curious about that. And also, based on your conversations with the staffers, is there evidence that this problem has, that she has worked to fix this problem in more recent days?
So Harry Reid in 2015, we were told by multiple sources, pulled her aside and had a private conversation with her to talk about the way she treats her staff and basically asking her not to do it anymore. And, you know, when it rises up to the level of the head of the Democratic caucus, you know that there is a bit of a problem there. And in terms of whether it's gone away, I mean, this goes back to her days as Hennepin County attorney. We talked about that memo when she ran for Senate in 2006. But in 2002, there were reports that the local union had asked the higher union at the state or national level not to endorse her run because of the way she treated her staff. So this goes back a long time. And the staffers we talked to have worked for her more recently. You know, I don't know comparatively if she's better now than she was then, but this has definitely followed her to Washington, and the reputation is still there.
So I've seen that since this initial reporting came out from the Huffington Post, other outlets have been sort of doing some research in this area as well, including BuzzFeed. I saw Stephen Colbert made a reference to your reporting. Some, though, at least in my experience on social media, have criticized the reporting that you and your colleagues did, either because they believe that this is just opposition research, sort of dirty laundry being aired, or some are saying that this is the sort of criticism that you wouldn't see of a male candidate, that somehow your reporting is helping to advance a sexist narrative against the senator. How do you respond to those criticisms?
So first on the opposition research, that's not what this is. I mean, opposition research is when, you know, you look at a candidate's voting history, or you look at some, or, you know, you look at what's publicly available. You look at yearbooks, for example, and see what's out there. You know, this is something that we got by talking to people. We heard this from quite a few people. And so we decided to do more interviews and look into whether these claims were valid. This was just basic old-fashioned reporting. We've also been criticized because some of the people who talk to us are anonymous. But honestly, in my opinion, this is what anonymous sources are. These are people who have less power, who are trying to expose something that someone in power and who is more powerful is doing. And understandably, they're not comfortable with their identities being revealed. If they are, great. But the people we talked to weren't. And the other point on whether this is something that a man would get, you know, I have reported for years on toxic work environments. Most of my reporting has been about men. And I've also reported for years on the double standards that women face. You know, we saw this with Hillary Clinton, for example. This is not that, in my opinion. If it were, I wouldn't have published it. But I think that it's important that we hold men and women who are creating toxic work environments to account, just because that there are many, many bad male bosses out there for years who didn't get written about. Doesn't mean we shouldn't write about the women now. We should write about men and women who are doing this. And I think that's really important.
So I guess I'm just curious, as we get geared up into this primary, I know that anytime we do, like, we're critiquing a lot of the candidates already. Anytime we say anything negative about any of these candidates, the people who have vested interest in their candidacy react poorly to it. Do those sorts of concerns at all play into your choice of topics, the pulling the trigger on actually publishing something? Are you at all concerned about that pushback?
No, not at all. I mean, I expect that as well. And that we want to anticipate, I should clarify, we want to anticipate valid pushback. You know, we went into this story very well knowing that people were going to be upset about it and wonder whether it was unfair because women are often criticized for being tough bosses in a way that men weren't. So we looked at our story through that lens and made sure that we didn't have any biases and tried to write it in that way. You know, people can argue about whether we were successful in that, but that was something we're aware of. So we do try to anticipate valid criticisms. But, you know, look, we know that there are going to be a lot of liberals out there who may really like Elizabeth Warren, Joe Biden, you know, whoever we write about, but those stories need to be told. You know, the media needs to do a good job vetting the candidates on the left, just as they would on the right. And, you know, the progressive movement is not going to be unified this time in the primary. You know, there are just too many candidates out there.
I couldn't agree more. And so good luck entering into that process. I have a feeling it's going to be a bumpy ride at points. But Amanda Turkel of the Huffington Post, thank you so much for joining us. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
We're going to take a short break. When we come back, the latest from Virginia. Who will be left standing at the top when all this is done? We'll break it down after this. Welcome back to the Damage Report. John Derola, Brooke joining me as well. Nice to have you here.
Did you forget I was here for a second?
No, I was introducing. I always do in the third block. Okay. We're going to be ready for Hostmates. I don't know what this concern you seem to have.
I think we have a shtick, mm-hmm. and I think we should just stick with it. Mm-hmm. I don't think we should do any extra studying. I think this is our thing.
No. So here's one aspect of our thing. Each Monday show, I want to learn a new fact about you.
Okay.
Okay. So think of one. We'll have it in the fifth block. You tell me a fact about you. Okay.
Okay. I like that. And same.
Same. Okay, mm-hmm. We'll do that.
Okay.
Equally important, the situation in Virginia. Virginia's political scandal around blackface and sexual assault continues. I don't know eventually what's going to end up happening there. Will their entire top leadership be cleared out? It is entirely possible at this point. But the governor, Ralph Northam, he appears to have no intention of stepping down despite continued missteps around dealing with the situation. Right. So here is a section of a recent interview he did where he made some questionable choices.
I know this has been a very difficult week for you in the state of Virginia, so where would you like to begin?
Well, it has been a difficult week, and you know, if you look at Virginia's history, we're now at the 400 year anniversary. Just 90 miles from here, in 1619, the first indentured servants from Africa landed on our shores in Old Point Comfort, what we call now Fort Monroe. And while
also known as slavery.
Yes.
Yeah. An important correction, I would say. So he's being critiqued for at least one use of blackface.
Yeah.
And he chooses to call slaves indentured servants. Now he also when criticized
to
about this.
Think they were on like a carnival cruise ship, like just like yeah. when they landed here.
Yeah.
A little more
when
violent
got
than
off,
that, but okay.
It was, okay. Yeah. So he said, a historian advised me that the use of indentured was more historically accurate. The fact is, I'm still learning and committed to getting it right. Okay. So there were indentured servants in that period. There were some. They generally were not Africans taken out of Africa. And I think you should know that. I would say, if you're an adult, if you've been through the American education system, if you're serving elected office, especially in the wake of a scandal like this, that's a really weird, unnecessary slip up to make.
Listen, he knows what slavery was. Mm-hmm. And he also knows that blackface is racist and offensive. At this point, I think these are two examples of a grown man who unfortunately is in charge of leading a state who doesn't care.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like we don't even have to pretend that like he doesn't know that it should be referred to respectfully, like right, as slavery.
Yeah.
And that we should use the words that match the violence that it was. We don't have to pretend that he doesn't know that.
And the thing is, the reason why it's like some people, maybe if you're an international viewer, or if you, I don't know, like maybe come from Connecticut or something, where you were a little bit removed from it. Like you learn about it, but you're not growing up in the deep south or anything like that. Like you may not know, but there is a significant portion of Americans, especially conservative Americans, that are convinced that the way we talk about slavery is exaggerated, that it wasn't that bad, that it was benevolent slavery, they call it. It was like, okay, there was some violence or whatever, but they do that too much in the movies. And really, it was like, we gave these people a home, we gave them medicine and food. Like, that seems absurd if you're not dwelling in this every day, but you hear this on right-wing talk shows and things like that. And so I'm not saying that Ralph Northam believes in the concept of benevolent slavery, but I don't want to hear you minimizing how absolutely horrible it was.
Yeah, I mean, it's humiliating that a black woman has to sit there and talk to someone who's doing that. It's humiliating that his lieutenant governor, and obviously there's other issues that we have to get into with that, but would have to work alongside him. This is ridiculous. It's humiliating that the people of this state still just, like, he's just refusing to give them the respect they deserve. He's ridiculous.
So I've been curious how this is going to shake out in terms of, like, obviously there's been widespread political calls for him to step down from some of the highest profile
positions. He is going to go down kicking and screaming.
Yeah. There have been polls. What do the people of Virginia think? So considering everything, do you think Northam should step down as governor of Virginia or not? Interestingly, amongst all Virginia adults, it is exactly split. 47-47, yes or no, he should step down. Whites are slightly more likely than not to say he should step down.
Yeah.
African Americans are less likely to say he should step down. My theory is that this is only differentiating people by racial group and not by race and politics. And so I imagine there are a lot of white Republicans who are saying he should step down, not because they don't like blackface, but because they don't like a Democratic governor in Virginia. Whereas you're probably seeing less of that effect in Virginians that are African American, perhaps.
I also think sometimes, like, people, like, this is not the worst experience of blatant racism that people in Virginia have had to deal with on a daily basis in 2019. And so I think sometimes people are just numb.
They're habituated to
like
it.
This.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, maybe.
Of course the governor's racist. Like, I wonder if people, you know.
Maybe like growing up, we've seen far worse. So I guess, he wore it.
Yeah.
I don't know, but we got some polling on that too. So first of all, do you approve or disapprove of the way he's responded to the photos discovery? 22% say, yeah, he's nailed it, approve it. But most don't believe it. And there was a similar question, like when he first came out and said he hadn't done blackface, and then he immediately reversed it the next day. Do you buy that switchover and his explanation? And the same, like, 20% were like, yeah, totally honest, I buy that. Now, here's the more troubling, perhaps. So overall, I believe this is all Americans. Let's bring up this chart, and you're gonna see, is it acceptable for a white person to use makeup to darken their skin as part of a Halloween costume? Always acceptable. Amongst all adults, 15%, 18% of white adults say it is always acceptable. An additional 21% of white adults say it's sometimes acceptable. I would even count the 16% who say rarely acceptable, still think it's acceptable. So that's 18 plus 21, that's 39, 49, 55% of white adults say, it's not forbidden.
The most respectful thing was that first, the group of people on that first line there to have written in the answer, it's not okay for me to have an opinion on this. Can't answer. It's ridiculous to even think, let me tell you what I think black people should feel about this. No, it's not racist. Like, it's because it really comes down to how offensive it is to black Americans. And so if you don't move through this world like that, if you can't then experience personally that offense, it's inappropriate, I think, to be able to say, no, I don't think they should be offended. Like, that's so, it's almost, the whole poll is ridiculous to me.
Yeah, and there are overall, there are obviously very large gaps between white and black responses to this. 5% of black Americans say it's always acceptable, but 53% say never acceptable, much higher than the 35% amongst white Americans. So there is that big split. I don't think that's really shocking anyone. A little bit of good news in this next one, just briefly, 18 to 29 year olds are least likely among whites to see blackface as acceptable. So you perhaps see a little bit of progress there. Hopefully that's not the sort of opinion that changes once you hit 35. I don't exactly know why it would, but you never know. So look, he is still insisting that he is not going to step down. He believes that he is exactly the person to heal these divisions. That's debatable, I would say. But it doesn't look like he's going to step down. And I wonder, once you make it past the first 2 weeks, when people are like saying there needs to be action, inevitably, it seems like that usually drops off. And so I wonder if he might actually make it through.
Yeah, this is disappointing. You know, I don't know, it comes down to, for me, is that during the election, a lot of young progressive voters of color and not, did not have all the information about him and supported him and got him, and he just snuck into the governor's seat. And it's gross.
Yeah. Yeah. Hopefully he'll be a little bit more careful, although that indentured servant comment makes it seem like
he won't. Step down.
Yeah.
But
no, I mean, even if he were to slide by, hopefully he would learn from this, but I don't see much learning yet. Outside of just the governor, Virginia has other scandals going on, and that is the continuing scandal around Justin Fairfax, lieutenant governor. So that has to do not with blackface, but with sexual assault. Now, first, a Scripps College professor named Vanessa Tyson came forward this last Wednesday claiming that Fairfax forced her to have oral sex after what started as a consensual encounter back in 2004 at the Democratic National Convention. Days later, there was a second accuser, that is Meredith Watson, who went public with allegations that Fairfax raped her while the two attended Duke University in 2000. Fairfax has unequivocally denied the allegations and says both incidents were consensual. And sort of around this, there have been calls for him to step down as well. There's at least one representative in state government in Virginia that says that as of today, there will be impeachment proceedings against Justin Fairfax. Both of the women say that they would cooperate with some sort of inquiry into what happened. He, I believe, has called for the FBI to investigate, but that generally isn't what would happen in this sort of situation.
Mm-hmm. We saw what happened last time the FBI was called in to investigate, and alleged sexual assault.
Yeah. So what do you see happening with this?
Nothing.
Nothing.
No, I don't. I think a few months from now, I see the structure of Virginia's government looking exactly as it does now. Unfortunately.
Yeah. I mean it. It would seem like after the last few years, this would be taken more seriously.
Right.
Someone could attempt to make the case of why exactly these two women would be viciously lying about the nature of these incidents with him. I mean, people who have spoken with them, friends of them, say that she had previously talked about this in the last year or two. I don't know what the case is that they would be lying, but hypothetically, an investigation could find out whether there is truth to it. I don't know that it will actually end up happening. But the fact that there is a representative at the state level that's pushing for impeachment, that makes it a little bit more serious, a little bit more likely that there will be some sort of justice.
In these situations, the protection is always on the man, though, because when two people are in a room and there's no videotape and there's no police report, it just goes to who do you believe in? Yeah. Historically, we just generally believe the man.
Yeah, even in the wake of the Me Too movement, it seems pretty clear where the presumption
lies. It has taken 90 women coming forward together for anyone to barely get in trouble. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
Look at Donald Trump back during the election. I mean,
exactly.
How many women came forward and they're just now off?
Yeah, so I mean, do you see either of these two men stepping down?
It certainly doesn't look like it. Again, once they move past those initial days, they're probably going to feel a little bit emboldened. If Northam apparently, there are reports from his inner circle saying that in the immediate wake of the blackface photo coming out, he was going to step down, but then decided against it. And once you make that choice, and he's already faced a bunch of political attacks, to the extent that that could influence him, it doesn't appear to have.
I mean, he basically slept on it and woke up in the morning and decided, you know what, they can't prove either of those two men are me. So let me give them what they probably could prove if someone gets a video of my proud talent show performance where they probably announced my name.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's just, ugh.
Yeah.
And so I don't believe at all that he was ever thinking about stepping down.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But well, I know that's looking. What's being said.
We're going to see what happens. Yeah. I don't expect much out of this, but it's entirely possible. Yeah, we do have to move on, though. So on the other side, Jenny Wetter is going to be joining us, break down the recent Supreme Court moves on the future of reproductive rights in America. We'll be back after this. Last week, the Supreme Court blocked the immediate implementation of a Louisiana anti-abortion law in a 5-4 vote. So maybe don't get your hopes up about the future of reproductive rights under this new Trump-affected Supreme Court. Joining us now to help break down what things might look like in the next year or two, Jenny Wetter, Director of Public Policy at the Population Institute. Jenny, welcome to the Damage Report.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Very glad to have you here. So let's start with that vote just last week. It was 5-4 with the Chief Justice joining liberals to stop that law from going into effect. But Kavanaugh, for instance, wrote a dissent implying that the assurances we were given during his nomination hearing about his commitment to continuing Roe v. Wade might be coming up a bit short in practice. What are your thoughts about this?
Absolutely. So this is definitely good news in the short term. So thinking that the clinics in Louisiana are still open, and that's great. The concern is that 2 years ago in 2016 in Whole Woman's Health versus Hellerstedt, a very similar trap law was blocked by the Supreme Court. And Brett Kavanaugh showed that he was willing to overturn a decision that was only 2 years old. The good news is that for now, at least, Justice Roberts was willing to block that from happening. But that doesn't, I don't think that gives us a lot of say into what will happen when the Supreme Court decides to hear this case next year, probably.
Well, and we, at the time when we were reporting on this last week, we went back to a portion of Senator Susan Collins' remarks about Kavanaugh. So she did the big speech explaining why she felt okay in voting for him. And she spoke very specifically and very hyperbolically about his commitment to respecting precedent in the Supreme Court. How much hope do you have that he won't just abruptly throw the entire thing in the trash bin in the future?
I mean, none. I think that he's made it, this decision made it very clear that he is not going to respect the precedent when it comes to Roe. He also was pretty clear when he was talking about precedent that he did not mention Whole Woman's Health. So, you know, it seems pretty clear that he is not going to support this decision in the future. And I think this gives real pause when you think about going forward, thinking about Roe. Not just that he might overturn Roe itself, but that it could be a death by a thousand cuts by continuing to approve all of these restrictions that are in place until women just have nowhere to turn.
Well, and it's interesting because we know that there are already multiple cases working their way up through the system that inevitably will go before the Supreme Court. So whether he is thinking about this in terms of, yes, I'm going to do death by a thousand cuts, the movement on his side certainly seems to support that. What do you think about the likelihood that the Chief Justice, in the same way that he joined the liberals in this case, do you have much faith that in the next, you know, 1 or 5 or 15 challenges of this sort over the next few years, that he will do that?
You know, I honestly don't know. I think that he is really thinking about his legacy, and I think he's kind of making that clear when he talks about the court. So I think there is a chance that he could try to find some of that balance. But that said, he was one of the four who dissented in Whole Woman's Health versus Hellerstedt. So it's a very real possibility that he would continue to have that same frame. So there's some hope, but I don't want to tie all my hopes on that.
Now, I'm also curious, I know that for a number of different reasons, regardless of what your most important issues are, the idea that Ruth Bader Ginsburg might be replaced on the court under Donald Trump is, that's a scary thought. When it comes to this area in particular, though, do you feel like if that happens and Donald Trump gets to replace Ruth Bader Ginsburg, is that effectively it for Roe v. Wade in the Supreme Court?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a really scary prospect. You know, you see her name trending on Twitter and you kind of have to do a deep breath of what's going on. I would be very scared. But I'm also worried right now. Right now, we already see that where you live really depends on how you can access your reproductive health and rights. And this court right now will probably make that worse. And if the court makeup were to change again, it would be really devastating for women, particularly low-income women.
So for people who might be watching the show who live in various states scattered across the country, and as you sort of implied there, are engaging at these state level battles over many of these rights, some in context of states where there's effectively no access to these sorts of freedoms, or there's one clinic, you know, somewhere. What would your advice be for those who want to do what is necessary to protect reproductive freedoms? How should they be acting?
Well, I think right now you see a couple of really good examples of states that are taking steps. You had this big furor over the last week over the New York Reproductive Health Act. I think that's a great example of a state laying down where it stands on Roe. It says that even if the Supreme Court overturns Roe, we're going to make sure that the rights enshrined in Roe are protected. So they made sure that their state law was at the minimum of where Roe's at, where it wasn't before. So I think that's a real opportunity for other states to stand up and make the kind of the same decisions to make sure that if in case Roe is overturned, that the women in their states are protected. And I think that it's also super important to find out what reproductive health access looks like in your state. I think a lot of people aren't necessarily aware if they're not in a state particularly where you hear a lot about, like Texas or something. So it's really important to get informed about what reproductive health access looks like in your state.
I think that is great advice, especially with the future of these rights in the Supreme Court being very uncertain at this point. So Jenny Wetter of the Population Institute, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
So we're going to take one last break, a little bit more after this. Welcome back, everyone. In a second, we're going to turn to the Green New Deal. But first, let's learn a little something about our hosts.
Okay.
Brooke, if you could go to one place on the face of the earth, one trip, and that's it for the rest of your life, where would you go?
Do you have a guess?
Do I have a guess? Paris.
No, you know what's weird? I would go to Haiti. It's actually, they have like a really beautiful like beach side.
Yeah.
And I just think it would be a great experience for me.
That sounds like it'd be beautiful, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay, that's a good choice. Now I feel even
you?
More shallow than I would have otherwise.
Were you gonna say South Carolina, Charleston? You wanna go Charleston?
I'm gonna go Charleston. I've been there.
Nothing wrong with Charleston, it's just thinking of a random place.
One of the ways that I am most like an animal is or a child is that I like bright lights.
Okay, okay.
I like being in places with a lot of bright lights.
So like Walmart?
Yeah, I would go to a Walmart. Anyone? Okay. No. Okay. I really like Times Square. I've been to New York a million times. I still like going to Times Square.
If you could only
go
one.
No, that's not where I'm gonna go.
Oh, okay.
I really like the Vegas Strip. Lots of bright lights. Uh-huh. It's dark, but it's bright.
So
I like
your
that.
Last trip ever.
Tokyo.
Oh, okay.
I wanna go to the All brightly right. lit portions of Tokyo right, where there's yeah. lots of stuff going on, and I think that would be a fun trip.
I agree.
Yeah, I really want to see Rome, but I guess I only get to go to one.
So, wait, you also like you wanted what did you say? Like if I was being executed, what would be my last meal?
Yes,
I think I would just have like a really big pot of like homemade macaroni and cheese that my Aunt Wanda made because it's really really good, and then some cornbread.
That sounds good. Mine would be similar.
Made. Really,
I would have a big bowl of pasta. It would be penne in a tomato vodka sauce.
Okay.
With spinach and big chunks of Italian sauce.
That would be so bad in prison.
Yeah, okay. No, I get to bring in a top chef to do
it,
obviously.
Okay,
so stay tuned for more facts about John and Brooke later on, but not right now. Now we're talking about the Green New Deal. So we've had the details of the Green New Deal proposal, a call for specifics coming from AOC and the many dozens of co-sponsors she has. It has been received, shockingly, very well by the right, and since it came out, they have been honest and open about their concerns and about what it actually represents. I'm just kidding.
Right. No,
they've been crazy. And so Media Matters has done a great job of collecting some of the responses, the bat-ass responses to the Green New Deal. Here are some.
Now, green energy, this new deal will destroy America, our economy as we know it. It'll turn back the clock.
Run it back.
Lunatics in the Congress would like to prove their virtue by destroying the U.S. economy. It's called the Green New Deal.
A Trojan horse filled with socialist planning.
She wants to change the way you heat your home, the way you cook your food, replacing air travel with trains.
Sorry, Hawaii.
Unionize all jobs, guarantee income for all, even those who don't want to work. So quit your job. Why would we wake up early and come to work when when the country's going to pay for us?
You're dragging the majesty of the creation, weather. Climate. It's the weaponization of weather, the weaponization of climate.
Exclusive video of a hellscape that is the result of Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's Green New Deal.
Radical, extreme Green New Deal. It's literally insane and anti-American.
She doesn't know her ass from her elbow.
So measured response, I think we can agree.
Right.
By the way, so the not knowing her ass from her elbow, he's very interested in many body parts. Ben Stein went on to say, why do we even listen to her? I mean, she's charming and she's very good looking, but why do we even listen to her? What a weird, weird, creepy old man. But anyway,
what
back to the Green New Deal.
Creepy old man.
So I was hoping that we would be able to debate the merits of individual parts of this, but we would all acknowledge that something needs to happen and we should be looking out for the best interest of our people and we don't want, you know, millions of people to die over the course of the next century from climate change. They're not going to take part in that, though.
Yeah, but because it's coming from, they just refuse to respect her. And I think it's just because someone who they feel is just undeserving of this type of power snuck in. Mm-hmm. And it really wasn't sinking in at all. And
yeah, I mean, look,
they're rightfully, and she should be where she is.
She worked her ass off, yeah.
Right, and she's really smart and really deserving of it. But it's just, they just refuse to respect her.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that they would oppose it either way, but there is something about it coming from her.
Because mm-hmm. Look at how the response is. It's not even, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, they've gone absolutely insane. There's more, we unfortunately don't have time, but if you go to Media Matters, you will be able to see more of these reactions. Absolutely insane stuff. Imagine how they're going to act for 4 or 8 years when she's president.
Can you believe when she wears a tan suit for the first time?
Oh my God. And you know what? She's going to rock it.
Right?
She is. Sorry, right wing. That's going to happen. Okay, thank you everybody for watching. Thank you for being here.
Yes, thank you.
And telling us a little bit about yourself.
Yeah, same.
I was going to find out more about my favorite host. And thank you for watching, everybody. We'll see you tomorrow with more. Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.